Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
My guest tonight, Elizabeth Moss, is one of this generation's most dynamic actresses working on stage, screen, and television. She is known to millions of fans around the world for her award-winning role of Peggy Olson on the groundbreaking television series Mad Men, which is finishing up its run on AMC. Her performance in Jane Campion's critically acclaimed miniseries, Top of the Lake, earned her numerous accolades and prizes, including the Golden Globe and Critics' Choice TV Awards for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Movie or Miniseries. Elizabeth played Zoe Bartlett, daughter to Martin Sheen's president and Stockard Channing's first lady, for 7 seasons on Aaron Sorkin's award-winning drama, The West Wing. Yeah. On the big screen, she has just completed production on 4 new films: High Rise, co-starring with Tom Hiddleston, Sienna Miller, and Jeremy Irons; the drama Meadowlands, starring with Olivia Wilde and Luke Wilson; Queen of the Earth, the psychological thriller written and directed by Alex Ross Perry; and Truth, starring with Robert Redford and Cate Blanchett. Additional film credits include The One I Love with Mark Duplass, Listen Up, Philip, directed by Alex Ross Perry and starring Jason Schwartzman. On stage, she co-starred opposite Keira Knightley in the Lillian Hellman classic The Children's Hour in London's West End, the Broadway revival of David Mamet's Speed the Plow opposite William H. Macy, and her New York stage debut with the Atlantic Theater Company in Franny's Way. Well, now she is back on Broadway, giving one of the finest performances of the season as Heidi Holland in Weni Wasserstein's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, The Heidi Chronicles. And today she was nominated for an Outer Critics Circle Award for Best Actress in a Play. Please welcome Elizabeth Moss.
All set.
I love that. Check the shoes out. Great shoes, lip gloss, and orange juice. I love it.
It's a Monday night.
Monday night. First of all, thank you for doing this on your one night off.
You're welcome.
Right? You are giving one of the finest performances of the season.
Thank you. It's very nice.
What are you enjoying the most about playing Heidi in The Heidi Chronicles?
I suppose at this point in the process, I'm enjoying finding new things, which is such a strange thing after doing something for like 3 months. And all of a sudden, you know, you're looking at another actor on stage that maybe just in that moment, you've never looked at them at that moment in the play before. And that makes you think something, and then that makes you do something different. And after, you know, 4 weeks of rehearsal, a week of tech, you know, 3 weeks of previews and then 60 something performances, it's so strange to find new things, you know? So I suppose at this point, that's what I'm enjoying, and the confidence that comes with having done a show a little bit and you feel like you know your lines and so you can try other things, yeah. You know, and you can let it go a little bit. That's what's been fun lately.
I'm sure just finding the pace, because, you know, you go to rehearsal, you go to tech, you preview, you do press events, you open. There's so much other things you have to do besides just doing the show, right?
Yeah, I often wish I could just do 8 shows a week. That would be relaxing.
How familiar were you with the play prior to being offered the role?
Shamefully, I had not read the play. I was familiar with it as sort of an epic play and as a prolific event, but I had not actually read it, and I certainly hadn't seen it. So I sort of I honestly practically said yes just hearing what it was, because it was one of those things where you're like, oh, yes, this is something that I should do. And then after I read it and met with Pam, of course, it was like a definite yes. But yeah, I wasn't even as familiar with the play after reading it as I am now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what attracted you to the role, and how do you describe Heidi? Such a beautifully written role.
Yeah, it is just really beautifully written. And I like the fact that she is complex. I like to play characters that are heroic but flawed and human. And I like the fact that she is... that you sort of believe in her and you want her to succeed, but you also, she makes bad decisions and wrong choices and is sad. And then, you know, at one point is kind of sad for a lame reason. And I that's what attracts me. And that's what attracted me to Heidi. And I enjoy playing with, you know, how strong she can be and how weak she can be and how that changes sort of every show.
No, because she's a character with so many flaws, and I would think that would be the best kind of character to play.
Yeah, and it's also what one of the things that I was really excited about was the journey through time. I've never really played a character that I guess has spanned that many years, and she goes from 17 or 16 or something to, I think it's like her late 30s, early 40s. And we're not really doing anything to play particularly like, oh, now she's 16 and now she's 40. It's very much in the text. But I did want to show an emotional journey, and I did want to show someone sort of growing up in a way. That for me was the challenge that that I really haven't done before.
Yeah. And it's all in the text, isn't it? It's such a beautifully written play.
Yeah, it really is. And it's like it's in the scene, first scene, well, there's prologue, and then the first scene, which 1965, and she's 16, 17, me and Allie Ann, who's wonderful, plays Susan, we kept getting notes to not be so young, not be so young. And what we kind of realized eventually was we didn't have to play young. It's all in the text. Yeah. If you just say the lines and follow the story, they come off younger. You don't actually need to play it. And it happens in every scene. The next scene is 3 years later, and the text just... she is a little bit older. You don't have to play it a little bit older necessarily. You just sort of follow it.
Yeah. She grows in the play itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That and you then actually got notes early on about.
Yeah. Not so early on too. A little later as well.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to be like, I'm 16. And so now I'm going to play 16. And you don't need to do that when it's good writing.
Actually, what'd you say? Good writing? Because you normally don't get that.
No.
You're like, now play 16.
So, right.
Yeah, I love that. Mm-hmm. This is such a dialogue-heavy play. Mm-hmm. How did you learn it? Were you off book right away, or how did you learn her?
No. I'm a procrastinator. I very much identify with something that Heidi says in this. She has a 4-page monologue, and she talks about how she waits until the desperation point to complete or rather start her homework. And I very much identify with that. I didn't learn that 4-page monologue until like maybe a week before we went to the theater. Just because I didn't want to. I just was like, this is really scary and I don't want to learn it. And then we started doing runs in the room and I was like, oh shit, now I have to learn it because people are watching and I can't have the pages and this is embarrassing. So I did learn it. I'm good at memorizing things. I have a good memory for lines, so it's not the end of the world for me to wait till last minute. But no, I procrastinate till the very end.
Mm-hmm. No, I had Stocker Channing here and I asked her about learning dialogue.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the show that Stocker's in, it's only a play, and Nathan Lane learns his role, everybody else's role, and the stage directions. I mean, he knows everything.
Yeah.
And Stocker said, Richie, once I have it in my head, I'm fine, but it takes a long time for it to get up there and stick. So I always wonder how it was, like, with your cast, was everybody off book at the same time or not really?
Yeah, we were very cohesive, actually, with that. We all kind of, there was a very kind of clear point when, there always is a clear moment when you are becoming hindered by the script in your hands and you are wanting to do things with the blocking that you can't do because of the script. And that's a very clear sign of like, all right, it's time to get off book. So we all kind of did it at the same time, maybe halfway through rehearsal or something. Yeah. I had the most to learn.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Plaza speech and then the last scene was the last one that I learned.
Lots of dialogue.
Yeah, a lot of dialogue.
Tell me about working with director Pam MacKinnon and what makes her such a great director.
She really is wonderful. She's one of those people that just says one thing, like one line, one sentence about something, and you kind of, about your character or about a scene, and you kind of go like, really? Like, is that what you think? Like, can you, I remember at one point Jason was like, can you do that about every line in the play? Can you just talk about every line of mine in the play? Jason Biggs, who's in Heidi. She just has this incredible ability to put things into words, which is pretty great for a director. She has a great way of explaining things and a great way of painting something for you without telling you exactly how to do it. Something that I think would be very difficult. I don't know if I could be a director because I'd find that very hard. She's very in tune with the text. She's very, she's also kind of one of those directors, and I've experienced this with every great director knows when to say they don't know about something and knows when to say that they don't have the answer. And, she does that, you know, we would ask a question in the rehearsal room and she'd say, I don't know, you know, and we'd go back to the script and we'd look at it and we'd talk about it. Or she would ask a question and she'd be like, I don't know the answer. I'm just throwing that out there. Yeah. And to me, that's it's a very, very good trait to have as a director.
Yeah. Brilliant cast. I mean, you mentioned Jason Biggs, Bryce Pinkham. Talk about working with your two leading men. Then we'll get into the ladies. What's it like working with Bryce and Jason?
I'm very, very lucky. Yeah. I knew I was lucky from the very beginning. I saw Bryce in Gentleman's Guide. I was sort of sent to go see him.
Yeah.
And he blew my mind. You know, I sort of, as soon as the curtain went up and as soon as you started singing, I was like, yes, we should cast him. He's perfect. And then I met him afterwards and he was so nice. And then Jason, I thought, was a spectacular choice for it. And Pam had read with him and auditioned him for it. And she was like, he did such incredible things in the room. And we all got together for a drink back in December. And it was kind of immediately just perfect. And Jason was kind of a little bit like Scoop and Bryce was a little Peter, and it was just like the perfect kind of triangle. And they've been so professional, so nice. They're good men. They're like good, kind men and, brilliant on stage, I think.
And then there's your ladies. What a great ensemble group of ladies you work with.
I know. It's so incredible. Yeah. I mean, this cast, everyone pulls their own weight, and those ladies, you know, most of them do 3-4 roles.
Yeah.
And this play would not be anything without them. If there was one weak link, I don't think it would work. And they're all so professional and so talented and really egoless. It's like an egoless cast. There's no divas. There's no one that you wouldn't want to get stuck in an elevator with. You know, like they're all really nice, great people.
Yeah.
It's very lucky. It's not always like that. So I'm very lucky.
It's a great ensemble cast to work with. Really great.
Yeah.
You know, what I love the most about the structure of the play is that Heidi is the lead, but there are some key scenes where you're the observer, which I'm fascinated. I love to watch you listen to them. How did you work with Pam, your director, on those scenes when Heidi's sitting back listening?
We knew, you know, reading the play, that Wendy did this brilliant thing where she sort of sets up Heidi is being very open and very confident and trusting and very kind of speaking her mind. And then she sort of goes like this, you know, she goes down. And then there's this whole kind of first three scenes of the second act where she doesn't say that much and then finds her voice in that Plaza speech and doesn't stop talking for 4 pages. So it's a brilliant way to construct this story. So Pam and I worked on having her physically be, as you know, like in the baby shower scene, being physically stage right away from the other ladies. Originally, there's this lunch scene, and originally I was in between the two actresses, and we changed it during previews so that I was actually on the right side. So I was left apart from them, so they were sort of ganging up on me. Just stuff like that you just felt like she was being left stranded, literally, like physically. It was interesting to find, you know, there were moments when I would want to like get closer or get more involved in something and having to be like, no, like I can't, I have to stay stranded.
You know, you started to talk about, there's an emotional public meltdown speech in Heidi, for those of you who haven't seen it, and for those who have seen it, it's so brilliant. How did you work on that speech? I mean, it's literally 4 pages of dialogue. Explain the scene, what happens, and how you worked on it.
Yeah. She goes to speak at her high school graduating class, and it's like a women's meeting, and it's a luncheon called Women, Where Are We Going? Which is just total Wendy Wasserstein wit, you know? And she goes to speak at this class, and she's just feeling totally empty and stranded, and she didn't prepare a speech. And so she starts to sort of weave this story and tell, kind of explain why she doesn't have a speech. And ends up talking about all these ladies around her in this locker room when she goes to this exercise class, and sort of paints this really interesting picture of all of these women, and then talks about how she, and then she sort of breaks down and starts crying, and she's like, I feel stranded, in a nutshell. But we didn't do a lot of work on it, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, like it was our most sort of, it was the scene we spent the least amount of time on. I don't really know why. I didn't disagree with that choice, though. I think part of it is that it doesn't really, it's really hard to do without the rest of the play. Without having everything leading up to it as an actor, it was, you know, sort of lame to just like rehearse it without doing anything else. Because it required being in such a state emotionally. And it really needs the context of the play. I also feel like I think that Pam knew that I knew what needed to happen with it and trusted me in that, which I very much appreciate. And it's all there in the speech, really. I mean, it's all... She gave me the best advice Pam ever gave me about that speech. She said, we were emailing about it once, and she said, just follow the speech. And if you do, you get where you need to go. It's all there. It's all in the writing.
So when you worked in, take me back to the rehearsal process, when you were working on the play, did you work from the beginning to the end, or did you work on specific scenes at different times?
At the beginning, we worked from the beginning to the end with the blocking. And then we would go over act one, and then we would go over act two, and then we would go over like some scenes and then some other scenes. And at one point, it was really confusing. And then we would just focus on, you know, the scenes that we needed to work on. We did a lot of work on this one scene that we call Hello, New York, because it was difficult to figure out. So we did a lot of work on that scene. Every time it would come up, we would all be like,
not that scene again,
not
right?
That scene again. Yeah. And now it's like the funniest scene in the play, and everyone like loves it. We hated rehearsing it. But yeah, we were all over the map, all over the map. We didn't actually run the play from beginning to end with costumes and hair on stage with lights and everything. We did not do a full run through until the invited dress. And our first preview was the next day.
Really?
Yeah. Because we have a massive tech.
Yeah.
Because we have a lot of scenes and a lot of, it's almost like a musical. We have more drops than Cinderella, the musical, apparently. So it was a huge tech. We really should have had 2 weeks for tech, but we didn't. We only had 6 days, five days, 6 days. So it was we just didn't get I remember when I found out that we weren't going to do a full run through until the invited dress, I was really nervous. Yeah. I was really scared.
No, technically the scene changes are amazing in this show. Like, it runs like a musical.
It really, really does, with music and transitions and lights and projections. And it's a big deal, the show.
It's incredible because there are projections from every decade that it changes to. You watch all these incredible TV scenes and commercials and pictures and covers of magazines, and the music score is great.
Yeah.
Did that help you transitioning during the process when that was added into the mix?
Definitely, definitely. We added music in the rehearsal room. Chuck, our stage manager, would do it on his computer. But it definitely helped because we range from 22 to like 35 in the cast. And so it helped us to understand when we heard the Fleetwood Mac song and when we heard, you know, respect and imagine in these songs. It helped to place us as much as it helps to hopefully place the audience in each, you know, of the each of the scenes and each of the years as they go by.
You know, this play was written, what, 25 years ago. It's still relevant. What do you admire the most about playwright Wendy Wasserstein and the play with working on this?
I think her ability to laugh at herself. She makes fun of people in her plays, but she makes the most fun of herself. And her ability to cover the sadness, but then also let it speak. There are lines in the play that are just so truthful and brilliant that I feel like no one has ever said before, that when you say them, you find the audience, you can hear this pause for a second as they think about it. And then they laugh, you know, and it, you can, and it's all her. It's because which, there's this one that says, where I say, I was wondering what mothers teach their sons that they never bother to tell their daughters. And it's so like, huh, that's a great line. And it's so truthful, but it's also funny. And that's what I admire about her.
And just the relevancy, I mean, the things that have changed for women, things that have stayed the same. There must have been so many conversations in the rehearsal room saying, my God, this could have been written today.
Yeah, for sure. She's very, you know, she was kind of very much ahead of her time in the sense that she was, you know, now we have like, Girls, the, you know, Lena Dunham show, and then before there was like Sex in the City, and there's like, now there's all of this, like, we all talk about ourselves all the time, and, you know, women talk about women all the time, but at the time that was not really done as much, and certainly not in theater and by a female playwright, so she was very ahead of her time, and the decision to adopt a child by herself, which, you know, Heidi does, spoiler alert, but she does at the end of the play, was a very different and new concept. Now we're kind of like, oh yeah, people totally do that. But that was a new thing at the time. So she was very ahead of her time. So for me, it's less about the relevancy and more about her prediction of the future, you know. I also, having done Mad Men for so long, I have no questions about the relevancy of that kind of material and about women's rights and feminism today, you know? Yeah.
Well, let's get into that. You are known to millions of fans worldwide for playing Peggy Olson on the groundbreaking television series Mad Men. Mad Men fans here tonight? I cannot believe it's ending. I cannot believe your show is ending. Just so you know, I'm going through total withdrawal. We're going to talk about your withdrawal too. How did Mad Men originally come about for you? I never heard that story. How did you get cast?
I auditioned for it. There were two pilot scripts at that time that everyone was talking about that were really good. And Mad Men was one of them. And then this other one won't be named. But I auditioned for both of them, and the one that won't be named was like the cool one that everyone wanted to do, and I didn't get that one, and but I did get Mad Men, and that other one was canceled after a few episodes. It's just a little side note; doesn't really matter.
I love it.
But I auditioned for it. I auditioned twice. Did the same two, three scenes both times from the pilot. Pretty much did them the exact same way, I think. That was it. You know, it was just another audition. It wasn't anything special. If I hadn't gotten it, I would never remember it.
Who did you audition for? Was it the casting director or was Matthew Weiner there?
It was our casting director, and it was who cast the pilot, who was not the casting director for the show. And then Matt and Alan Taylor, director, and Scott Hornbach, our executive producer.
How did you find out you were cast?
I don't remember, honestly. All I remember was that there was a movie at the time. There was an independent film at the time that I got as well. And my agents, who are no longer my agents, wanted me to do this independent film because it had these kind of famous people in it. And I remember there was like all this like, oh my God, which one? And you can't do both and blah, blah, blah. And I said, whatever happens, I remember calling them and saying, whatever happens, don't lose Mad Men. Whatever happens, don't, if you have to pick one, pick Mad Men. And that was sort of like news to everyone because nobody, I mean, it was on a network that nobody'd ever heard of. It was pretty like, you know, no stars. It was about advertising. You know, it wasn't exciting necessarily. So I just remember that. I remember thinking, I don't think that we should not do that pilot.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad.
I know, me
you
too.
You didn't take that movie and you got rid of those agents.
I did the movie too, actually. Yeah, they worked it out.
Well, for me and for me and many others, Mad Men will always be Don Draper and Peggy Olson's story with all of these other incredible and indelible characters running through your lives. At what point during the process did you realize that Peggy would become such a beloved and important character?
I don't know. I still kind of don't necessarily think of it like that. I do think of it as John's show, and then the rest of us are sort of the ensemble around him. But as far as her becoming an important part of the show, I suppose like season four, I kind of was like when we did the suitcase, not only when we did it, but when everyone responded so well to it and everyone really liked that episode. That was kind of like, I felt so much pressure about that episode because it was just me and John. And I was like, oh God, like I can't mess this up. Like, what if people hate it? You know, like it's just me. they're going to be so disappointed. And then people really liked it. So that was the kind of like, I was like, oh, okay. People don't get mad if it's me on the show. you know, I don't, I'm not very bright sometimes about these things. It takes me a while. So it took me a while to realize that she was important to the show.
Did you ever think at some point that she would not have the type of journey she had or the type of big role that you had? Or were you told early on that she'd be on through the whole entire season?
Oh, no, I never knew that it was going to be a big, important part. I thought that she was going to be secretary. I thought that, you know, I was going to be part of the ensemble. I was going to be one of the women on the show. I didn't think that I had no idea that she was going to have so much to do. I had no idea that she was going to sort of rise in the ranks and have this relationship with Don. And no, I didn't. I did not know.
Talk about working with your creator, Matthew Weiner. What's that whole process been like?
It's funny because I was just actually saying there's sort of this like myth that has been sort of put out there that he doesn't really like talk to us and doesn't like tell us about the show and doesn't like tell us what happens on the show. And it's kind of not true. We just don't tell you guys what happens on the show. But he talks to us. And I mean, I've spent hours on the phone with him, you know, 5 a.m. with him pitching me ideas and telling me what about this and saying lines from scenes that are coming up that don't even involve me, like, which anyone that knows a writer knows that that's what they do. They tend to like pitch you things and see how you respond. I've known the ending of Mad Men for like 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
But you know, it's a very more collaborative, I guess I'm saying, than I think people think, you know. He does actually listen to you. He does actually respond to you and takes your reaction into account when he tells you what might happen on the show. And then, you know, changes his mind sometimes. But it has been a collaborative relationship for the last 9 years.
Yeah.
Thank God.
He's worn a few different hats on the show, hasn't he? He's directed some episodes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What was it like working with him as a director, too, besides being the creator? Like when you have him on a set directing episodes with you?
It's not really that different because he's just around more. Because he has such control over the show and because he has his hand in everything, which frankly, as he should, you know, I mean, he is where this came from. So I have no problem with that. So it's kind of actually just better because then he's just there and can just tell you right away what it is that he wants rather than having it, later on having to reshoot something or having him, have to edit something. Or it's actually just kind of more relaxing in a way because you can just hear it directly from him in the moment, like, oh, this is what you wrote. This is what you want. Great. Let's just do that. Yeah. So I actually found it easier in a way when he's directing, sure. Although we've had, some incredible directors as well, which has been really cool.
And working with the incredible cast. I mean, what a great ensemble of actors on Mad Men.
Yeah. They're pretty amazing. Yeah. It's a funny, they're my friends, my family. And sometimes I don't watch the show that much. But if I do, like at a premiere or something or a screening and I'm forced to watch it, I have trouble watching myself. I'm always like, oh God, Christina's so good. And like I turn around, she's like sitting behind me. She's always sitting behind me. And I'm like, you're so good. Like it's just, you forget, like you see it when you're working with them, but then you forget how good they are because they're your friends and you know them as your friends. And they're just, Vincent Kartheiser, I am convinced, is one of the greatest actors that we have. Like he's incredible. And if you meet him, you will understand what a good actor he is because he is nothing like Pete at all. He doesn't even look like him, talk like him, stand like him. Like he's incredible. So it's just, they're amazing. I got really lucky for sure.
Yeah. Was there a specific season for Peggy when she changed the most for you? Or grew the most?
I think they all kind of blend together.
Yeah.
I think, I feel like season five. I think season five was a bigger jump for me than before, if I'm right. I think that she became a lot harder and a little more bitter. And she developed this sort of wit and sense of humor that she didn't have before. And then I feel like she sort of regressed back into who she was closer. I feel like Peggy becomes more of who she was when we started by the end. I felt like she got kind of very Dawn-like in season five and was trying to be like Dawn and was trying to be like hard and tough. And, which was really fun to do.
Yeah.
But not very Peggy.
Yeah. She changed so much every season. When you would start the season, would you look at the scripts and say, how is Peggy going to change this season? And what questions did you ask yourself or ask Matt about how she was going to grow?
Matt and I didn't talk very much about Peggy as a character. It was one of the only things that we didn't really talk about that much.
Really?
Yeah. And we acknowledged that we didn't talk about it. It was one of those, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of scenarios.
Yeah.
We talked about her, but we didn't talk about necessarily how something should be done. Because we were on the same page from the beginning, from like my audition. So it was like, let's not mess with it. It was all very apparent always in the first script what had happened. And it was always very organic as well, how she had changed. And not unlike how I had changed in the interim time. Because she got older, but I went from 23 to 32 during the show. So there were things that would be very eerily similar to my own life, ways that I would change that would be in the character. And I wasn't quite sure if I was putting them there or if the writers were putting them there. I didn't know if it came first, like the chicken or the egg. And so it wasn't really, it was always kind of obvious in a way. If anything, I didn't want to change. There was a little bit at one point I was worried about her changing too much and had to sort of make sure that she was still Peggy. But then that turned out to be part of the story, so it was kind of great.
You're all so perfect, like you said. I don't think anybody else could have been cast in these roles. They're so indelible in our minds.
Thank you. You said,
Vincent. I've seen Vincent in other things and spoken to him. And like I said, he's nothing like Pete.
No.
Nobody is.
Yeah.
Robert Morris. No, but seriously, they're so beautifully written and they're so beautifully acted in this series. Do you remember the very first day shooting that first episode of Mad Men for the pilot? What was that first scene and what do you remember?
Oh, boy. Considering I don't really remember what happened on the episode last night. I feel like the first thing was, the first thing I think had to be, I might be wrong, but I think the first thing was me and Joan walking down the hallway, I think, with the box. I think that was the first thing we did. I'm not exactly sure, honestly.
Okay.
A while ago. but I think that might have been the first thing. Yeah, because we shot it in Midtown Manhattan.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the last day like? Do you remember your very last day on the set of Mad Men and what you filmed and how you felt?
Yeah. Can't tell you what we filmed.
Oh, okay. That's right. Okay. Because we haven't seen it yet. Okay. I didn't think about that. There's a few more to go.
Yeah. I do remember my last day was the last day of the show. And it was sad. It was very sad. It was very teary.
Yeah.
It was very strange. And I remember doing my last scene, and it was just very weird. You know, you're almost have like an out of body experience, because as you're doing it, you're like, this is the last time I'm going to play this character. This is so weird. And then they say cut, and you're like, we know that's it or whatever. And you're like, that was it. That's it. That's she's dead. She has died. And it's a very strange feeling. It's just weird. It was sad, but it was also, it felt like a proper goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Mad Men is a groundbreaking series that helped change the face of television. It will go down the history books. Why do you think the show is so successful and has touched audiences so around the world?
I mean, I don't think it's any one thing, you know. I think that it's very well written.
Yeah.
It's very well acted. It's very well done with the direction and the editing and the sound and the sets. Everyone is so good at their job in every department. So I don't think it's ever one thing that makes something good like that. You know, if it was really good writing but looked like shit, then you wouldn't want to watch it. And if it was like... Well, it's hard to act bad writing, but if it was like really good acting but bad writing, nobody would watch it.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not just any one thing. I think it was all those things. And I think that it was sort of like a revolutionary idea for people to recognize themselves in these people from the 60s, you know, like from the bygone era. And I think I remember people kind of in the beginning were like, oh my God, we're still like that. Oh my, you know, and like, oh my God, we're not that different. And they could see themselves in these people. And that was sort of revolutionary for a couple of years there for those first couple of seasons. Now everyone's kind of used to that idea. But that was something new, you know, like sort of turning the mirror and reflecting it back on everyone and saying, really? Have you really come that far?
Yeah. What will you miss the most, or what are you missing the most with Mad Men not shooting anymore?
I think just playing Peggy, honestly, because I see my friends still, and you know, we text and we hang out, and so they'll always be a part of my life. Hopefully I'll work with a few of them again at some point, but I won't ever play her again. And she, as lame as this sounds, like did sort of become my friend. You know, it's sad. But she sort of did. She was like this person that grew up with me. And I liked her a lot, you know. And I loved playing her. She was really funny. And I always thought she was so funny. And so for me, that was that's something that I won't be able to get back.
Yeah.
So that's the thing I'll miss the most.
I want to go back to the beginning for a second. Where did your love for performing begin growing up? And what were your early creative outlets?
I don't remember really not wanting to do this. I was a dancer as well for many years. I did ballet. My whole family was artists. So for my family, being anything else but in the performing arts in some way would have been weird. And mine was ballet, and then became acting, and then was acting and ballet, and then was just acting. I loved musicals, movie musicals. I loved Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and all those, you know, Singing in the Rain and My Fair Lady and West Side Story I loved. So all of those movies I would watch on VHS, and those were like, for me, that was just singing and dancing and acting. Oh my, you know, it's like the greatest thing anyone could do. I don't remember not wanting to do it. So I'm very glad it's worked out, because otherwise I would be in Schitt's Creek. I don't know how to do anything else.
Do you want to do a music?
I would never be a Baby June.
Okay, well, see, that's Wikipedia.
I wish.
You would be. I thought you would have been great. Baby Louise in Bette Midler's TV version of Gypsy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it like working on that?
I was 10.
Yeah.
It was cool. It was cool because we got to go to rehearsal, and we had dance rehearsal and singing rehearsal. You know, it was like a musical.
Yeah.
For me, being like so into musicals, I was like, this is amazing. And I totally knew who Bette Midler was and like loved her so much. And I loved that movie For the Boys. Getting to work with her was really exciting and scary and awesome. And it was great. I loved it. It was hard, but it was great.
Great TV movie. Great cast in that, too.
Yeah.
But Peter Riegert and Christine Ebersole. There were some great people in that.
Wow.
So you don't watch yourself. Do you? You really don't watch yourself on film or TV, really?
If I can avoid it, I try to, yeah.
But you've had to do stuff for the DVDs of Mad Men, right? Like the commentaries?
Yeah. And I watched the show, and I'm like, this is so good. I really enjoy it. I have seen quite a bit of Mad Men. It's hard to avoid. But it's difficult for me to watch myself and then go act. That's all it is. It's not like I'm not trying to be, precious about it. Yeah. It's just that it's difficult. It's like when you hear your voice on an answering machine and you go and you just never want to speak again, you know? You're like, oh my God, is that what I sound like? Imagine that with everything, with the way that you look and the way that you walk, and you're just like, oh God. And it's very difficult to get out of your head. So I can't, because I get too self-conscious.
Oh, I have to watch all the commentary now and all the Mad Men's now.
Yes.
I'm gonna listen to you.
I'm always watching them, and I'm always like, oh, this scene is so good.
I'd like to chat about some of your other memorable stage roles. You got to play Martha in the Lillian Hellman classic, The Children's Hour, opposite Keira Knightley in London's West End, directed by Ian Rexon. What are your fondest memories of that experience?
Working with Ian was incredible. He's an amazing director. He did, most notably, here in the States, Jerusalem, which I don't know if anyone got a chance to see, but Mark Rylance was incredible. And he's a wonderful, wonderful man. One of my favorite directors I've ever worked with in any medium. And he had four women to contend with, four very different women with very different ways of working. It was me, Kira, Carol Kane, and Ellen Burstyn. And so it was four unique women. And he handled us all beautifully and worked individually with us, and was just, he was wonderful and so funny and sweet. So that was my sort of favorite part of doing that, was getting to work with him. And then we had like a million girls, and they were all like really fun and cute. And Kira and Carol were amazing, and Ellen, and it was really cool.
Was it cool doing a play in London?
Yeah, I liked it. It was different, you know. It was different being... theater is difficult, you know. It's hard to do that many shows a week. And that many shows a week when you're out of your home country got a little tough at the end. It was less different as a... Like, people say, like, oh, theater in the West End is different because, you know, it's like a stuffier audience. I didn't find that at all, actually. I found that they were a very warm audience. I don't know if it's changed or something over the years. But I found our audiences there were fantastic, and I didn't feel like they were that different than New York. Yeah. But, you know, just being away from home for that long was hard.
But this was a goal you set for yourself, wasn't it? Because you had gone to see, what was the play you saw and you saved the tickets
to? 12th Night.
Okay.
Yeah.
At the RSC?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you framed it?
Yeah. I framed it, and I put it in my dressing room. I went to go see it, in London, and it was just blew my mind. It was such an incredible production. And I went to go see it by myself, bought a ticket and just went by myself. And I was like, oh, I want to do a play on the West End. This is real theater, you know, British people. and I saved that stub and I framed it and I put it in my dressing room when I did the children's hour.
That's great.
Yeah,
I love
cool.
that. Okay, in Speed the Plow, you were brilliant.
Thank
as
you.
Karen. People see Speed the Plow. First opposite Raul Esparza and Jeremy Piven, and then you worked with Norbert, Leo Butz, and William H. Macy in David Mamet's play. What are your fondest memories of that? And how did you all deal with the Jeremy Piven thing of walking out of the production, Norbert literally going in with the book?
Yeah.
You can take this any way you want.
Because
I saw
you.
All of them. I saw you with Raul and with Jeremy, then I went back, I saw Norbert, and I saw William. So I've seen all of them.
Yeah. There's definitely a positive and a negative to it, you know? The negative was it was very difficult to be left by when there's three actors in a play to be left by one of them. He just didn't show up on a Tuesday. Kind of thing. And our understudy went on for a week. Understudy went on for a week. So that was hard. We almost closed. It was difficult to, Norbert came in, thank God, and was amazing.
Yeah.
Jeremy was fantastic in the play, by the way. I mean, he was wonderful.
Yeah.
Just didn't want to do it. But then Norbert came in and was amazing and, yes, was on book. And there was something exciting about that. You know, we were all of a sudden rehearsing during the day, and it was very, like, you know, we're going to – there was very no – there's no business like show business, you know, and it was just kind of very exciting and – hard and Norbert would go on and went on with the book, and it was really, you know, cool, and the audience loved it, of course. And then we got, you know, Bill Macy to come. And so for me, the positive was I got to work with not just two great actors, but I got to work with all of these great actors.
Yeah.
I got to have many different kinds. I did like many different versions of the play in a way, you know, and because there's not that many female Mamet characters, it was, you know, nice to have that. My favorite part of doing that has to absolutely be Raul Esparza, who I think is one of the single greatest, not only actors, but human beings on the planet. He's just a lovely, lovely man, and we had so much fun. And I learned so much about what you can do on stage from him, and he just was so vicious and fabulous and terrifying and amazing, and we had to really stick together because it was just the two of us and the crew and stuff, you know. So we really kind of went through the trenches together, and he never was anything but incredibly professional and kind. And I loved working with him. Oh, I hope I get to do it again. He's wonderful.
You learn so many life lessons from going through something like that so quickly, right?
Yeah, you really do. I mean, I thought, oh, well, at least that's probably not going to happen again, you know, like that, like doing a regular Broadway show should be easy.
Yeah.
If everyone just stays, I'll think that it's a piece of cake.
Totally. But you were so wonderful in that. It's such a great part for you, and it was so beautifully directed.
Yeah.
And it must have been great to say David Mamet's words.
Yes, it was. I mean, I'm such a huge Mamet fan. I really wish I was a man at times because, well, many reasons, but because there's so many great Mamet roles for men, you know, like, oh, it's just this, and I love his work, and sort of, you know, it makes my skin crawl, and it's awful, and I love it, and I just think, you know, he's brilliant. But there aren't that many parts for girls, so I'm hoping to do Oleana at some point.
Great.
Because that's like the only other one, really.
Another great role.
Yeah, another great role.
You are known to legions of fans for playing Zoe Bartlett, daughter of Martin Sheen's president and Stockard Channing's first lady, on Aaron Sorkin's TV drama The West Wing for 7 seasons. We had Stockard Channing here last week, and she said she adored everything about the process of working on West Wing and working with Aaron. What was it like for you?
It was... I was 17 when we started that.
Wow.
And did my last episode when I was 23, right before I did the pilot for Mad Men. So that's kind of this other chapter of my life. It was different from Mad Men in the sense that I was a reoccurring, so I wasn't around as much, you know. I was mainly on during the Aaron Sorkin years. And it was, I was 17, and all of a sudden I was working with these people, these incredible people like Allison Janney and Bradley Whitford and Josh Spencer and John Spencer and Richard Schiff and Martin Sheen and Stockard Channing. I was like, I mean, what? Like, these people are amazing. And so I hope that some of it just rubbed off on me, honestly. Like, I hope that I learned something from working with them. I certainly learned about, you know, being a really professional, nice person from Martin Sheen, who is the nicest person in the world. Like, just so, so sweet. Like, knows the name of the guy who opens the door, knows the name of, like, every crew member. Like, he's just an angel. So I learned that specifically from him. But, I mean, I got to not only work with these actors, but say Aaron Sorkin's words, which is, like, amazing, you know? I mean, it's just such a gift.
Did you know you'd have the kind of run you had? Did she start out as, like, you know, 3 episodes or something?
It was always episode by episode.
Wow.
I think, pretty much, yeah. It was supposed to just be, I think, a couple, and I certainly did not know that it was going to go in any of the direction that it went at all.
Mm-mm. When you started, did you sort of know the history? Because when Stalker told me, she said, I got in the set, and Martin was like, hi, I'm Martin. He's smoking a cigarette. And we're married. And she's like, how many years have we been married for? This many years. Roll. So, I mean, she learned everything as she went along. So did you know your whole backstory sort of when you started or not really?
No. but I'm very bad at that. I'm very bad at backstory anyways.
Okay.
I get very bored very easily.
Because some actors love that. And some people are like, no, I just want to do what's in the script. Don't give me a backstory. I'm not going to tell you a story.
I just forget. I forget to do it. No, she was like 18 and went to Georgetown. Like, what was there to know? Like,
exactly.
She, you know, she she was, you know, not unwealthy, not... Yeah. You know, sort of middle class, smart, you know, probably a little bit more intelligent because of her upbringing and because of what had she had had to deal with, you know, in her life with her father. But, you know, nah, she was like a kid.
Yeah. So great on that show.
Thank you.
You won the Golden Globe for Best Actress for playing Detective Robin Griffin in the Sundance Channel miniseries Top of the Lake. Written and directed by Jane Campion. What was it like working with her?
She's an incredible woman. She is very unique. She's very similar to Pam in a lot of ways. And I don't just mean because she's a woman. I mean because they both have this ability to kind of say something very astute and very true that kind of makes you realize that, like, they can unravel your whole character in like one line, and you're like, wow, I wish I would have thought of that. She also has the ability to say that she doesn't know. We were doing one scene where there was with another actress, and she gave me all of this direction on the other actor's coverage. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you giving me notes? Like, the camera's not even on me. You can't even see what I'm doing. And she kept like giving me notes, and, it kind of messed with me a little bit. It kind of like messed up my performance. And then we turned around on me, and it was like total shit. And it was bad. And she literally walked up to me, and she was like, I'm so sorry. That was bad. That was totally my fault. I'm so sorry. Forget everything I said. And like, that for me is totally Jane. Like, she would just be the first person to be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I totally fucked you up. Never mind. You know, like, just go back to doing whatever it was you were doing. Like, she just was... She's so willing to laugh at herself and willing to make it a collaboration, you know, and willing to say that she doesn't know it necessarily any better than you know it. And she's a good friend, too. She's one of those people that would, if you needed some place to live, you could go live with her. You know, like, she's really, like, a good friend.
There's no ego there, is there, with her?
No, God, no. Oh, my God. She would be the first person to make fun of herself. I went over to her office sometime late last year in Australia, and she had all these, like, awards on the table. Yeah. And they were, like, next to, like, the... like Oscar and like the Independent Spirit Award and like the Cannes whatever thingy, these like giant awards were just like little things that she was like, oh, I just picked that up at like the blah, blah, blah. And she was like far more interested in this little knickknack than like the award that was right there that I was like, is that for the piano? Like she just is, she genuinely does not give a shit about herself, which I really appreciate.
Everybody who's worked with her says the same stories.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's good to hear.
They just love working with her.
That's good to hear.
You have just completed four new films that you did after Mad Men, right?
Yeah.
So one of them is High Rise, where you're co-starring opposite, is it Tom Hiddleston?
Yeah.
Sienna Miller and Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
Who do you play in that?
I play Luke Evans plays, is also in it. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's wonderful. And I play his wife, and I'm very pregnant and very put upon as his wife, and I end up sort of having a little dalliance affair with Tom's character. It's, if anyone read the book, the High Rise, no? All right. Anyways.
Go see the movie.
Yeah. Don't read the book, just go see the movie. But it's a sort of famous book, and it's a very, if I don't know if anyone's familiar with the director, Ben Wheatley. He did this movie Sightseers, and he directed this film. He's super out there and so interesting, British director, just like crazy. And it's going to be a very strange, interesting film. But I saw a little bit of it recently, and it looks great.
What attracts you to projects? Is it sometimes the director, sometimes the script, sometimes the role? Does it vary?
I would say the script first. I've worked with a lot of first-time directors, so often it's not the director because I've never seen them do anything. They often have written the script, though, the first-time directors. So it's the script absolutely first and foremost. I don't care how much money is involved in it. I don't care if it's got a producer. I don't care if it, you know, it just for me, it's very much about whether or not it's a good script. And then next, I suppose would be the role and whether or not I find it interesting or whether or not it's something that I've think that I maybe haven't tried yet or seems interesting to me. Yeah.
The next one is a drama called Meadowland, starring opposite Olivia Wilde and Luke Wilson.
Yes, I wouldn't necessarily say starring opposite. I have like two scenes in it.
Co-starring opposite.
Yeah, they're the leads of the movie.
Who do you work with in the movie?
Olivia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who do you play? What was she like working
with? I play a Jersey crack whore. Swear to God. Now you know why I took it. No, the director, Reed, is also a friend of mine, and it's her first feature. And she was like, I have this part. And I was like, yes, please. And I have, like, it's a big gold earrings and, like, a push-up bra, and I learned to do a Jersey accent. Hopefully it's not totally embarrassing and horrible. But, I mean, when am I ever going to get cast as a Jersey crack host? So I was like, yes. I am in. It's awesome.
Queen of the Earth, which is a psychological thriller, which is written by Alex Ross Perry, who you worked with before, right?
Yes, we did Listen Up, Philip together. So this is our second film together, and it's completely different than Listen Up, Philip. It's about a girl who goes to visit her best friend after a breakup, and she basically goes completely insane and just loses her mind. And in a very spooky way, if anyone has seen the Polanski film Repulsion or more well-known Rosemary's Baby, it's sort of in that vein. In fact, I wanted him to do the movie in black and white, but he wouldn't do it because he was like, nobody will watch it. But it's a very, it's like a psychological thriller, but it's also very much just a character study of someone's sort of descent into insanity.
Oh, I can't wait.
It was very fun.
Yeah. And then there's Truth, in which you hopefully co-star
opposite
Robert Redford and Kate Blanchett. Did you get to work with both of them? Who did you work with?
Yeah, all my stuff was with Kate and a little bit with Robert. I know. That was awesome. Dennis Quaid and Topher Grace. The three of us, me, Dennis, and Topher, are sort of this team that works with Kate's character. Kate plays Mary Mapes, who worked at 60 Minutes alongside Dan Rather, who Robert Redford plays. And it's about what they call Rathergate, which is the sort of dissent of 60 Minutes and the bunch of people got fired. And you know, you should just read the book, this book called Truth and Duty. It's really interesting. But yeah, that was really cool. I mean, Cate Blanchett, like for me, if anyone, I mean, come on. For an actress, she's like the tops, one of the tops. So I couldn't speak to her. Couldn't speak. Like she would talk to me and I would just be like, why are you talking to me? She just is like Cate Blanchett, you know, she's Elizabeth. Like, ugh, it's amazing.
And I hear with Robert Redford, there's no ego there either. It's just, you just do your work.
So nice.
Yeah.
So nice. Like just lovely. And he just has these eyes, you know, those blue eyes. The same thing. I never learned how to talk to him. I got better with Cate, but I never really learned how to. He would like come into the hair and makeup trailer and be like, "Hello, how are you?" And I'd be like, "What does one say to how are you? I've totally forgotten." I don't remember. And he would talk about like, "Oh, when I was playing baseball, blah 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 blah," and you'd just be like, "Oh my God, you were the guy in The Natural. I'm talking to you." Or you'd be like, "Oh, when I bought the land that started Sundance, you know," and would tell the story about how he started Sundance, you know. I mean, the man has a channel, like he's like he's just and he's so nice.
Yeah.
But the bigger you are, the nicer they are.
Yeah.
It's only the mediocre that are assholes.
That's great. Yeah. We have a few audience questions. Is there something you know now? That's the best bit of advice, and it's true. Is there something you know now that you wish you knew when you were starting out as a performer?
Gosh. I suppose that it's going to be okay in a way. I think that I was talking to a class earlier, actually, it was the keynote speaker to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts graduating class. And it was fun. And I was talking to them, trying to give them advice and stuff. And I said, the last thing I said was, it's going to be okay. I wish I could have told myself at 22 when I was so worried about getting a job and getting an audition and money and money and money and money, you know, always worried about money. Like, and lived in a shitty apartment. And I don't mean like it's going to be okay, like you're going to make money. I just mean that you're going to experience things and they're going to be good sometimes and sometimes they're going to be bad. And you're going to get through them and come out the other side, hopefully a smarter person. So I wish that I could tell myself that, like, don't worry so much. It's going to be okay.
You know, a question that comes up here a lot is about auditioning. A lot of actors here hate it. Some people. Auditioning, did you ever like it? Did you enjoy the process? Were you good at it?
No. I mean, I think it's an unfair process. I think it's a very strange, unfair process. It sort of is what it is. There's nothing you can do. It's not like you can do a whole movie and then that can be your audition. You have to only do a couple of scenes, but it's unfair because you haven't had any rehearsal. You have no idea what they want. You have had no discussions about it. You're sort of going in with some sort of idea of maybe what they might be looking for and hoping that you somehow approximate it. And I think that it's just a necessary evil. I think that people don't get parts not necessarily just because, you know, they didn't do a good job, just because it's an unfair process. But it is what it is, and you have to sort of just be able to let it go, I think. You know, you have to just leave it in the room and leave it behind and not worry about it, because worrying about it doesn't help anything. The best advice that I ever got about an audition was from Jane Campion about Top of the Lake. I was talking to her on the phone. She was in Australia, and I was going to audition for Top of the Lake. And I was like, oh, my God, I have to talk to Jane Campion. This is terrifying. And I talked to her for, like, 40 minutes. And she said, don't worry about hitting the bullseye. Just get the dart on the board. And that was the greatest gift you could possibly give an actor. Like, I don't expect a complete performance from you. I don't expect you to do exactly what I thought you would do. Just show me what you think you might do. And that's, I feel like, the only thing you can do in an audition. This is a sketch of what it might be at some point.
That's the best bit of advice.
Isn't
coming
it?
Coming from her.
I know. Seriously. I was like, oh, it was so thing. It was probably that advice that got me the part. Do you know what I mean? Because it just made me like relax.
Working on stage, screen, and TV, is the process of how you approach a role different, or is it all the same?
Hmm. Film and TV are sort of the same, but camera versus stage is obviously different. Whenever I do a play and we have, because we don't rehearse that much in film and television, yeah. You know? So whenever I do a play, I'm always like, can't believe that we don't rehearse in film and television, because I'm always like, this is really helpful, you guys. It's really great. I've learned so much from this process. And it always shocks me that we don't do it anywhere else, you know? But there's just no time. Time is money, and they have to pay for rehearsal, and they have to pay actors, and so they don't do it. Stage being that you have to put on a production from beginning to end, you literally have to rehearse it. The producers don't have a choice. So for me, I, you know, obviously just having a rehearsal process is just a very different thing. It's just not what I'm used to. But, you know, Mad Men, that character I played for 9 years. So, you know, by season 2, 3, 4, 5, you maybe don't need to rehearse as much. Like, you've been playing this character. You've been rehearsing it all for months, you know. You know the character pretty well. So that's different in that way.
If you could sum up the best part of the experience of working on the Heidi Chronicles, what has it been for you?
I think at this point, watching the other actors find new things has been really interesting. And it makes me I get so proud when they do, you know, when I see Jason find something, do something new that he's never done before. After so many performances, I always I have to stop myself. If I'm not supposed to smile at the moment, I had to stop myself from smiling because I just want to be like, good job. you know, so that to me is seeing these people still working on it, still finding things, still trying, not giving up. That is inspiring to me to keep finding things. And it's very sweet to see.
Yeah. My final question is, what is the best bit of advice that you've been given, both personally and professionally, that you live by?
God. God, the best bit of advice? Both personally and professionally. I suppose this is gonna sound so sort of cheesy, but having fun with things. It's so cheesy and so, I don't know, I feel like it's such a cliche, but it's so easy to forget, you know? It's just the first thing that flies out the window when you're tired. And when you don't want to do it anymore, and then you can let your life pass you by, and you didn't enjoy it. So you have to constantly sort of. I know that I have to constantly remind myself to have fun and enjoy it. It's the only sort of regret I ever have is not enjoying something when it was happening. So I'm trying to get better at that. I'm certainly not perfect at it, but. Thank you
for doing this with us. If you haven't seen The Heidi Chronicles, please go to the Music Box Theater. Ladies and gentlemen, Elizabeth Moss.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.